We're really getting into it today. We're getting into the nitty gritty. So for those of you who are listeners, regular listeners, welcome to the second episode of my soft launch, relaunch of Beyond the Bedroom. I'm Birna, and I'm a sex educator, and I'm telling you that sex ed topics deserve their spotlight outside of the physical and sometimes metaphoric bedroom. From the health related to the raunchy, I am really digging into those public perceptions of sexuality and sex. I also talk about reproductive health. So for new listeners, I'm excited to have you. This is a really great episode to start listening to this podcast. But this is Beyond the Bedroom. Okay, you guys really want to talk about sperm, so let's talk about it. I mean, you're always asking me about these questions. I don't know what happened in the last couple of months. Maybe because I made that video that, you know, did really well. Maybe. I don't know. I'm not sure. There's like a sperm fever lately. Maybe it's always been that way. Maybe they're just coming my way. But yeah, a while ago I made this video about the epididymis. It did get a lot of views and a lot of questions. People were pretty confused about the whole life cycle of a sperm thing. So I'm going to break it down really quickly, real fast. I'll try to make it as non-lectury as possible so we can get into some fun questions. But I really do want to talk about other things too, like the taste, swallowing, all that stuff. And if you are here from my podcast I did in Icelandic with Saga when I was in Iceland back in January. If you are coming from that episode, I should rephrase that. If you have listened to that episode and you're listening to this one next, don't worry. This is not necessarily going to be a recap of that one. I'm adding on to it. I'm digging more into some of the science and also the sociological, some of the psychological. You guys know I'm not a sex therapist, so that's not really my realm, but I do like to dig into that stuff in this podcast. I feel like the podcast is very intimate, so I'm allowed to talk about what I want to talk about, you know what I mean? So yeah, we're also going to talk about why certain things involving coming on someone and doing things like that are hot, but like I said, let's go through and give the context for the anatomy, shall we? So the video I made was about that coiled tube in the testes called the epididymis, but I have to kind of take a step back and start from the beginning, I think. So 200 to 300 million spermatozoa, which is just the fancy name for sperm cells, are created in the testes every day, every single day. So new cells are constantly being made, but they don't all get to the end of the process. Some are reabsorbed and recycled by the body, and this can happen at any stage of what I'm about to break down for you. So right after they are made, they take anywhere from 30 to 90 days to develop into their next stage. By the way, I am not in a studio yet, so I'm in my bedroom. So you might hear the bus. God bless the DC metro system. You might hear someone honking. Just add some spice to the audio, all right? Add some context for where we are. But okay, so it takes 30 to 90 days for these cells to develop to the next stage, which is entering that little tube called the epididymis. And it does look small in the body. Like if you were to look at it in a cadaver, you'd be like, huh, like this is pretty small compared to the rest of the body, right? But if you were to unravel it, it actually is quite long. And that was the content of my video, that the epididymis is 20 feet long, that's 6 meters. And if you were to kind of unravel all that coil, and that's wild because that's literally like the length of a giraffe, that's two basketball hoops stacked on top of each other. It's literally the length of an orca, you know, like a killer whale, they used to call them. And I just find that really fascinating. And these are the type of facts that they really help get people interested in learning about reproductive anatomy. I'm full of fun, relatively useless facts like this about genitals, by the way. I don't know, it comes with the territory, I guess, of the job. But anyway, in this little coiled tube, the sperm mature over the course of about 5 days. So they develop the ability to swim properly in here, and they reach a point in their cell life cycle where they're considered mature cells. So essentially at the end of this journey, they're ready to do their thing and to get swept up into, you know, the system that helps them leave the body. But not all of them leave. Remember, like the 200, 300 million in the beginning, a lot of them don't always make it past the epididymis. So this isn't like a singular process. It's not like you just plop out 200 million and then wait until the next day. It's like they're always generating, maturing, and there are sperm cells in different life stages in different parts all the time. So it's kind of like how the uterus doesn't just create the lining all at once, like in one day, and then shed it all at once. You know, these biological processes are always happening in stages. So they're continuously developing, they're building off each other, which is really cool to think about, you know. But after the 5-day journey, like I said, they get scooped up into the vas deferens. So you might know this term if you've ever heard of a vasectomy. That's when they're cauterizing the vas deferens, or they're tying it off, right? From there, they go through the vas deferens, and from there, they go through the urethra in this like loop-de-loop. It's like a roller coaster, meeting up with more fluid in the prostate, and then eventually they get shot out of the end of the urethra after this signal from a place actually in the spinal cord called the ejaculatory center, which is kind of a funny, it's a very simple name for it, right? But it does the job. So that's kind of also why there's like this point of no return with male ejaculation. Once this reflex hits and starts in its progress in the spine, it's already on its way out and it has to come out. So that's not the same as blue balls, which I will get into, but that's just throbbing genitals from arousal. But this is when it starts that process. And for those of you who have held a penis before, right before it's gonna come, it's that feeling where everything starts to get really tight, and then it almost feels like blood is like swimming, you know, like it's rushing. That's kind of the indicator. And then there's this thing that lights up in the base of the spine, and that is this reflex that starts, and the process goes, and then the fluid from the prostate ejects from the penis. So I told you I was going to try to keep it short. Hopefully that was entertaining enough. But yeah, so sperm and semen are actually separate things. So sperm refers to the cells themselves, and semen is, you know, the cells plus this fluid, the seminal fluid. And you may have heard of the seminal vesicles. That's like that tube that also takes them from the vas to the prostate and out. Like they're all working simultaneously, all these tubes. And I actually love when, and I don't want to like call them out, but I've had multiple biology teachers, physiology professors, even like at the graduate level, that say like, oh, you know, the female reproductive system is just so much more complicated. But when I talk to people about the male reproductive system, they don't realize like how many tubes are involved, how many glands are involved. I mean, there's multiple glands making tons of different types of fluid. The fluid all has like these different properties. So yeah, it's not going through like a monthly change, but what it does on a daily basis is pretty complex as well. And not a lot of people can name all the different parts of the male reproductive system outside of like the testes and the penis, you know, maybe the prostate. But when I'm talking about these tubes and what they do, people get a little lost. So I think it is good to talk about this. Obviously, in terms of medicine and research and biology and physiology, we obviously know a lot. I don't want to say a lot more, but the focus in urology and the focus on the penis and on sperm, it's been there for a long time. So obviously, in terms of mechanics and physiology, there's a lot lacking still in the female reproductive system. But the layman, right, like the people that I communicate to, I'm noticing that a lot of them are really confused about what these parts do and how they come together and what they, you know, because in that video, a lot of people in the comments were like, no, they don't go through 5 days because they shoot out of me so fast. And it's like, I think you're just confused about what's happening, you know? And I get the same thing with the reproductive system for the female reproductive system. People are really confused as to, wait, we don't make eggs every month. They're just there. Like, it's these questions that really excite me. I know that sounds crazy, but it does excite me, and it makes me thrilled to be able to do my job. And a lot of people are like, isn't that sad that people don't know? And I'm like, no, like, well, one keeps me employed, right? I'm joking, but two, it is exciting to get to help people understand these things because they're hungry to learn a lot of the time. So going off this, so the seminal fluid, like I talked about, is that fluid from the prostate and the seminal vesicles and other glands. Like, there's this one called the bulbourethral gland, which is a fun one, that help the sperm to swim. Prostate fluid provides nutrients for the sperm's journey. It also raises the pH of the whole mixture so that it can survive in the acidic environment of the vagina and then eventually make its way up to the uterus. So there is a reason that ejaculatory fluid and semen is more basic, and it can mess with the acidic environment and the pH of the vagina, and it's so the sperm have a better chance of surviving. And then there's also that reason why the vagina is so more acidic, because of bacterial culture and also to help, with self-cleaning properties. People will say, why does it always happen that I get like itchy, irritated, I get BV, I get, chronic issues with pH whenever, when someone comes inside my vagina, like, why does that happen? And I don't want to say that there's like an evolutionary reason for this. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is there's a biological process there that when you start to understand these things, you go, okay, maybe it isn't always a good idea to let someone finish inside me, because like if I do that enough times, like obviously that fluid that has that pH is going to do this to my pH, And then there's those people who, like, nothing ever happens to their vaginas. They're like, they have like vaginas of steel, like they're just not sensitive at all. And they're like, huh? Like, I've never noticed any difference. So I think it's really individual too, but it is really cool to be able to say, okay, I know this about this fluid. I know this about this biological process. And so it makes sense that this is happening, it's not necessarily because it's like an undetected STI, although that can happen, obviously. Sometimes it's just that you should, give it a break for a while and see if it gets better. The semen is irritating your vagina, So a little tangent, but I know this is the semen episode. I shouldn't be chatting away about vaginas, but I cannot help myself, okay? So people also ask in relation to this, because I talk about the vas deferens, do you shoot blanks with a vasectomy? I think that term shooting blanks can be really confusing, and it's kind of like a really vague term, because what do they mean by that? Because yes, fluid does come out. And this whole process that I just outlined is also the reason why you have to wait a couple months after a vasectomy to make sure all of the sperm are out. Because there could be some in the tube that might have been cut off, but they're not totally out of there yet. And they can live for a while. They take a while to mature. And there could be some mature ones that are hanging out and they get through. So you want to make sure that, you're following those doctor's orders, because the last thing you probably want after you have a vasectomy is to have an accidental pregnancy. It happens. There's a lot of documented cases of people not realizing how long they had to wait and didn't go back for the sperm count test. And for the most part, you do have fluid come out. It looks and kind of acts pretty much identical to the regular fluid that semen sperm cells would be in there, right? Without the sperm cells, because you're cutting off their access point. So you're preventing the sperm cells from meeting up with like the prostate fluid. So all that's coming out of you is just the prostate fluid part. Because like I told you, semen is really two things. It's the sperm cells and the fluid. So after a vasectomy, you're just getting the fluid. I think a lot of people are afraid that like nothing will come out after a vasectomy, which I understand. I think that could be a really big change for people, especially if that's what you're used to, your whole sexual history. And then But that's not really what happens. You do have fluid coming out, and most of the time it's just going to be exactly the same as it was before. So let's get into some more fun questions. So why does semen taste like that? I know that that's kind of a funny way to put it, but a lot of people ask me this question. They're like, wait, so because the sperm cells take that long to mature, is that the reason that they taste that way? We're not really getting like fermented cells in the taste there. It's more likely that it's the fluid from, you know, the seminal fluid and the prostate fluid that's what we taste. And I think we have like a teaspoon or so that comes out. Some people have way more. It depends, you know, how long it's been, how excited they are, their pelvic floor muscles. There's like a lot of different elements that go into how much comes out and how it comes out too, which I'll get into. So semen is made out of water, plasma, and mucus. And I know that sounds gross. And before you're like, ew, 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 and turn this off. It's not like the mucus in our nose. It's more like the mucus that comes out of the vagina, right? That's technically cervical mucus, right? But it gets thinned out a lot by the prostate fluid. The prostate fluid actually has this material, this chemical in it that helps the sperm swim. And it also provides like this warm, nutrient-dense bath. That's kind of how we describe it in reproductive anatomy and physiology. We call it this like nutrient-dense bath. But there's also an enzyme that helps thin out this liquid. And also that's really what the reaction is. So if you've ever seen ejaculate like come out and it gets like weirdly thick and then it thins out and then it dries up, it's because there's like chemical makeup that's helping that happen. So it gets different textures for a reason. But anyway, back to the taste. So the minerals and the different proteins and stuff, they are not of any substantial nutrient value. There's like between 5 and maybe 20, 25, I don't know, calories in the average like semen ejaculate, you know? So the nutrients there are like so minimal. But it can, of course, be affected by lifestyle. So a lot of people ask, like, so does pineapple, like, does eating a lot of pineapple help? Some people swear by this. Like, yes and no. Like, there's things that have a really big effect. Like, if you are a smoker, if you've been drinking heavily, if you're dehydrated, if you've eaten a lot of foods that are high in sulfur. So things that are going to affect your blood plasma and sometimes your urine also, like things that have a really big effect on your urine might be able, you know, but then again, it's like it's going through the urethra, so we don't know if that's the reason. But the bottom line is, like, if you think that eating pineapple is helping, that's fine. I mean, you're eating fresh fruit, that's great. If you're eating like a lot of those products that are like supposed to make your sperm taste a certain type of way, I mean, I don't know, they're just candy, like they're just really high in sugar. Semen is just supposed to taste like the body, you know? It is not supposed to taste like cotton candy or like a smoothie. Like it's a part of your body. So if you're having issues with it, look at your lifestyle. So are you eating enough nutrient-dense food? Are you eating enough in general? Are you smoking? Are you drinking heavily? Like these are things that are really likely to impact that more so than like if you're not doing those things and you're just like not eating enough pineapple, you know what I mean? But if there's like a foul odor in the semen, like fishy smell, which is actually pretty common for people who have like chronic prostate infections, they have chronic UTIs. And by chronic, I mean either recurrent or just unable to treat, like prostatitis that is not necessarily a treatable bacterial infection. These are things that can influence. Also, you know, some people notice that drinking a lot of energy drinks can change the taste and smell of their semen. So it just doesn't, the evidence isn't there for me to be like, yes, it works. It's leaning towards like, it's a myth. But like I said, if eating a lot of fruit helps, then go for it. There's really no harm. So go for it. Okay, so that leads me to my next question. So which is hotter, spitting or swallowing? So already you probably know that I'm not going to say which one is hotter. Because they're both fine. Like, I don't know. There's this weird competition, I guess. And sex is a competition for a lot of people, whether they're competing with themselves or competing with the idea with that their partner has of them, or they're competing with the previous partners their current partner has had. Sex is often a competition, and it's often also a form of like a validation. So if you're doing something because you feel like you have to, because it makes you the crazy one in bed, or like the opposite, like, no, I'm respectful and modest, I could never do that, but you want to do something. This is a common theme for me. You're going to hear this a lot. You're going to want to reevaluate the reasons why you're doing things. So let me just, that's a disclaimer I like to get out of the way. But I talked about this with Saga. It was just like funny because we were talking about like spitting is often not about, ew, I want this out of my mouth. A lot of people actually are just like, that seems like kind of a big commitment right now. And I think that's really funny because it's just such a funny thing to think about, because I'm like, it's already in your mouth, you know? It just seems like more work to get up. Like, some people just don't think about it in such deep terms. Oftentimes I'm in that category where I'm like, I mean, it's just not that big of a deal to me, like certain things. But I meet people constantly that this question is still just such a big topic for them, and they feel really guilty about doing something one way or another. Like someone told me, I feel really guilty that I don't want to swallow. I can tell like he's hurt. And then someone else is like, I don't know, I feel like he doesn't respect me if I like want to swallow. It's wild how we attribute so much moral weight to these actions that we're doing. And it's crazy that I can talk about this for hours, you know? Like, I can talk about, like, the gender roles of it, and I can talk about, like, the chemical makeup of semen and, like, all this stuff. Like, I can really dig into this because when at the end of the day, we assign so much of our values and so much of just how we think about ourselves to these sexual behaviors. But when it comes to spitting and swallowing, it's like, then we open up this whole other door, right? Because people will tell me like, well, I feel like blowjobs are like inherently degrading. And I'm like, okay, that's okay. Like, you don't have to do anything you don't want to do. And then there's those people that tell me like, well, I feel like swallowing is inherently degrading. And then someone else will go, well, what's more degrading to me is like, he just like comes on me. And it's so interesting because it's like we all kind of have these different ideas of what is allowed, what's not allowed, what's degrading. And then there's some people that it's like, yeah, that's why it's hot. I think it was Dan Savage actually who, when he wrote about, I think it was facials, this is like years ago, he wrote like, yeah, it's degrading, that's why it's hot. And so a lot of people think about it that way, you know? But then there's people, I guess I fall into this category big time where I'm like, it's just like a decision that you make, and each time it could be different. Each partner, it could be different. I think it's because we're saying I'm a spitter, I'm a swallower. Like, we're taking this on as like an identity. And I would really love it if people stopped assigning these like identifiers. Just because you swallow a couple times when you give head or like whatever, it doesn't make you like personality. Like, who is the girl who swallows, you know? Like, I don't know. I just think that that's really interesting to also think about this communication that happens where, is he gonna get upset if I don't swallow? Like, it's you, it's in your mouth. And you don't have to be like grossed out or whatever, like audibly. You can just spit it out in your hand or in the sink or something, or just figure it out. I don't know. You know, I know this sounds so bad as a sex educator, but sometimes I really just want to tell people, I promise you are allowed to make your own decision. I promise you that if someone's upset, you didn't fulfill their fantasy or you didn't perform in the way they were expecting you to, I promise you, you can either talk it out or you can make sure you're not on a pedestal. I think that's something that happens a lot of the time when things aren't going the way that someone had imagined or hoped for or planned, or when things are embarrassing. It's at that point, it stops being like a sex ed issue and it starts becoming a communication issue, a security issue, validation issue. Do you see what I'm saying? And there's a big reason that I did not go into sex therapy, and it's because I'm more interested in the sexual side of things. I'm more interested in the physiology and also like the perceptions of sex, like the sociological impacts of sex and sexual behavior on health. It's the reason I have a degree in health and public interest with this, you know, emphasis on sexual health. And I love sex therapists. I have a lot of them that I refer out to. I've worked with a lot of them alongside clients with quite a few of them. But sometimes I just have to pump the brakes and be like, we are going into territory where it's not a question of is it hot or not, or is this right or wrong? And it's starting to become a question of should I be ashamed of myself for doing this? Is it okay if I don't like this? Who am I if I don't partake in this? And those are questions I think that are really important for people to figure out on their own, you know? But so yeah, spitting, swallowing, who cares? You know, like do your thing. And if you're the person though, like with the penis, don't like expect someone to do either one. I feel like as long as you ask if you can or where it can go, that's another thing. Asking where can I finish? People are really also concerned about that sometimes, which I totally understand. I mean, from a communication standpoint, it can be kind of awkward, right, to like pull away from the moment and like ask a question. But there are a lot of ways to like phrase it in a sexy way. But also it's okay, you know, I would rather that it's an awkward question than an uncomfortable reaction. You know, I'd rather it be awkward if you ask, where can I finish? Where do you want me to finish? Instead of like you doing something that someone was not prepared for, you did not give a heads up. That is not okay. When you're weighing these options, I feel like a little awkward moment is a lot better than the alternative. And I know that being awkward or being vulnerable or being just like, oh, I don't want to ruin the moment. Like, I know these things can be uncomfortable. And again, this is when I say, that's a communication thing, and we can definitely all work on that. There's so much to unpack there. So in terms of how much comes out, because we're talking about it coming out now, the volume of semen that's ejaculated depends on overall like health, like things like blood pressure, and then degree of sexual excitement. So how aroused are you? How turned on are you? How maybe even how long have you currently been touching yourself? That sometimes people notice that like more comes out when they prolong their orgasm, which is not always the case, but some people notice that. And then also time since you last ejaculated. This is pretty much the biggest factor. So if you like jerked off in the morning and then you're having sex at like noon, you're not gonna see as much fluid come out just because it needs to be regenerated, you know? And I talked about this earlier, but when you're coming on someone, sometimes it gets like really thick before it gets liquidy and then it dries out. All of this happens like within 30 seconds. I just think that's a really fascinating chemical response, I should say. So when people ask me, is it okay if I like it if he comes like on my boobs, or is it okay if I like coming on someone's back? People are always asking for permission, right? But the biggest one I get is facials. And it's funny that I mentioned this earlier with Dan Savage, right? In terms of it being degrading or humiliating or just sexy, you know? And for the most part, people who ask me this, it's never gay men for me. It's always heterosexual or cis heterosexual couples. Like, that's really the people who ask me this the most. I do want to give some context that like facials are not necessarily a new thing. Like, they've been depicted in literature and art, and I'm not saying that that's right or wrong. You know, there's a lot of things that have been depicted in history that are like not cool to do to someone, you know, but I'm just saying there's sometimes this argument that it's a 21st century behavior, and I just want to say that that's not true. I think even Marquis de Sade wrote 120 Days of Sodom, and that was like in the 1780s. Let me fact check that. Yep, 1785. So I just looked this up because I want to quote it verbatim, but Marquis de Sade, and this is his exact words about it. Keep in mind, this is in 1785, all right? I show them my prick, and then what do you suppose I do? I squirt the fuck in their face. That's my passion, my child. I have no other, and you're about to behold it. So this is, of course, Marquis de Sade, like, this is not like a great example of facials in history, but I do find it very interesting that people are thinking that this behavior and others are just the year 2000, just men all around the world just said, you know what, I think I want to come on her face. Like, that's not exactly what happened, you know? But obviously it was depicted more in porn. Porn became more accessible. So that's a big turning point. But the idea that it's just like never existed before in history is definitely. And I guess there are a lot of people who do find it hot because of the humiliating aspect. And then this kind of like what I was talking about earlier was spitting and swallowing, where others find it a form of like, I accept everything about you and I want you all over me, or I want you in me, you know, that kind of thing. And this takes it to another level where it's like, I'm letting you do this to my face. And I think this is a big cultural thing as well, because there's definitely some cultures where like, this is just so absolutely degrading. And then there's others that it's like not as big of a hot topic. It's like, well, yeah, some people are into that, some aren't. And I totally understand though, the like the humiliating, degrading aspect of it, because I think so many people see it as a way to lower the other person. It's like, I'm doing this all over your face, in your face. We say these things a lot, like in your face, you know? And I think the language obviously matters there. Some people liken it to the humiliation of water sports, peeing on somebody. And there's a lot of people that are super into that because it's hot, because it's degrading to them, because it's, you know, that's what they're into. There are a lot of people for whom getting ejaculated on anywhere isn't really a value statement. Like I mentioned with swallowing, it just feels good. So they did it with a partner. They asked, can you come on my boobs, my ass, my back, my face, whatever. And they felt great during it and didn't feel any shame after. And they just laughed and wiped it off and washed it off together, you know? But for others, they feel like they need to choose that place, maybe because it gives this like spectacular performance. And I always encourage people to experience rather than perform, but I understand also the excitement of the performance aspect. Some people get turned on by more of the voyeuristic quality, which is not always, you know, validation. It's just this voyeuristic turn on. But, you know, like I said, if you're thinking to yourself, I want him to come on my XYZ because I want to be the wild, crazy, cool girl and impress him forever, then maybe reconsider, right? And it isn't a performance all the time. It doesn't always have to be. You should just do whatever feels good, but at the same time, it's like you have to be mindful of the way it comes across. You should ask, even if it's not in their mouth or in their body, like you should ask where you can come, where you can finish, if you can even do that on their body. I remember, okay, this is like when I was in high school, my friend told me she was hooking up with this guy in the backseat of his car and she wasn't ready to go, as they used to say, all the way yet. And so he, I guess, they were just like making out. And he just, I guess, got so excited. They had their clothes on that he pulled it out and finished all over her stomach. And he like pulled her shirt up and just did it all over her stomach. And she was kind of just like, she couldn't stop laughing because she just thought it was so bizarre. And then she talked to me about it later that night. She was like on the phone with me and she was like, I just thought it was so funny. Like, it was just such a funny thing to do. And it was just so funny and so weird. But then similar thing kind of happened to another friend of ours. And I mean, she was just devastated. She was just absolutely devastated. So it's like, you never know how someone's going to react. So just, when in doubt, I mean, this sounds juvenile even to discuss, but there's so many people that ask me this, but just do it in your hands. Like, if you don't know, and it's this idea of like, I don't want to ruin the moment. I don't want to make it awkward or something. But like I said, I think someone would rather appreciate that or asking first or whatever, even if it's a little awkward or if you're like, oh, it's going to ruin the moment or whatever. If their body language isn't telling you what to do, if their words aren't telling you what to do, don't assume what you can do. You're going to need some cues, and it's better to make it a little awkward before it happens than do something weird, you know? So I surveyed some of my male listeners and also some of my guy friends. And they're all cis men, but they're not all straight. And I talked to them about finishing on someone. So not inside of someone, because I can chat about that later, but more like the money shot, like they call it, you know, the infamous porno phrase, the money shot. And here's what some of them had to say. They were saying that, yeah, this is hot to me because it is like the money shot and it's the culmination of all of my hard work and it's all over and I get to just see it and it turns me on. And I was like, huh, that's really interesting. So for him, it's more of like a self, I don't want to say centric, but that's kind of what it is in a good way, I guess. Makes him feel happy. Another person said that it's sex without reproduction. So it feels dirty, which is a turn on for him. It feels like I'm going against nature. And it's also really freeing because I don't worry about getting her pregnant. This is the same even if she's on the pill. I still just think, wow, this is great. No one's getting pregnant. Which I thought was kind of funny. Someone else said it felt like I was marking my territory, not to sound all dom weirdo, but she loves that and I love it. She's always asking me to give her hickeys and I don't like it, so this is my way of doing so. Interesting, right? Like, people have these different dynamics. Someone else said maybe it's just hot to us because it's the best feeling ever, so we assign good feelings to the image that comes across when it happens. So I think that's something I kind of subscribe to. How much of this is like a somatic response, you know? And I guess that works both ways. If you've had like bad images from it, it doesn't maybe feel as good. Someone else said, I just love feeling as much of my partner as possible on me, and I love spreading as much of me on them as possible. So that's kind of kinky. I like that in a very romantic, loving way. Actually, that might be my favorite answer. It really might be. I'm going to say that again. They love having their partner all over them, and they love like being all over their partner. That's some food for thought. Some food for thought. So before I get to my listener question, I'm going to do a little rapid fire round here at the end with some questions that I'm asked pretty frequently, and they don't always have super clear answers, but I'm going to try to do my best to condense them. What should I do if instead of my cum shooting out of me, it's just stopped doing that and now it's just kind of dripping or oozing? So believe it or not, I get asked this quite frequently, and people would assume that it's always maybe older people asking me this because, you know, obviously sometimes our muscle tone weakens with age, but it's actually sometimes younger and more frequently now like younger men that are asking me this question. And so I just want to state that I can't offer you medical advice. So the first thing I'm going to do is say, if there's a drastic change overnight, then the next couple times. So let's say one day you go from like just always, it like shoots out, it goes pretty far, you know, and then the next day it's kind of just doing that dripping, it doesn't feel the same. And then maybe the next time it also does that, that's a good time to, you know, if it's happening a couple times in a row and it's an overnight pretty drastic change, it's a good time to talk to someone. There's a lot of reasons for this. Sometimes it's an infection. Sometimes it's muscle issues. So it could be a pulled groin that leaves a little knot and it is causing pelvic floor dysfunction. There's a lot of reasons for pelvic floor dysfunction. It could be that there's something wrong with the prostate itself. Maybe there's just not enough fluid. So you're not seeing enough fluid come out. Sometimes it's because of dehydration, because of overdoing it. So if it's happening once in a while, I wouldn't worry about it. But if it's accompanying things like burning, pain, etc., then obviously go get it checked out. But if you're the type of person who like, it's always done this one thing and then just that stops. And like the next 5 to 10 times you come like in a row, it's just doing this, that's definitely an indicator that there might be something wrong and you should get it checked out. A lot of the time, men don't always take care of their pelvic floor injuries because they think, well, kind of embarrassing, or it's not that big of a deal or something. But you never know, like it can turn into a worse issue sometimes if you don't take care of it. But also you deserve to have the sex life that you want. So if it's indicative of a different issue, you want to go check it out. So the second one, are blue balls real? So I wrote about this back in June, and it's funny because I actually saw a post on the threads from a great urologist I follow. Let me pull it up because he honestly is fantastic and I encourage you all to follow him. Okay, so it's Merit MD, so that's with two R's. So it's Merit Di Bartolo, MD. He's a urologist. I've been really enjoying seeing his urology. We like follow each other on threads, and I've been really enjoying like seeing some of his breakdowns of research in urology. People often think too that if I had gone to med school and been like patient facing in my career, that I would have been an OBGYN, but actually I really love urology, and I think I would have ended up as a urologist or, you know, something along those lines. I would have also loved to be in, you know, I guess you never know. I mean, people say they want one thing and then when they start their residency, it can totally change. But he was saying here that this survey here, it about 2,600 individuals, and it found that only 41.5 of the respondents with a penis believed that blue balls is a real phenomenon. However, the study found that 40% of female respondents felt pressure to engage sexually due to a partner's fear of getting blue balls. If blue balls even exist, permitting to a poorly defined benign condition sanctions coercion and sexual violence, the violence is disturbingly prevalent phenomenon. And this is something that I've written about. I wrote about it last summer. This is kind of his take on it, and I really agree. So he said that epididymal hypertension, which is, remember earlier we were talking about the epididymis, so this is like a kind of a loose like medical term that's being thrown around. He said that as an explanation for testicular pain from deferred ejaculation makes no physiological sense. The pain of blue balls is more likely from an aggrieved entitlement manifesting as a somatization disorder like pain. Yet the epididymal hypertension hypothesis is often used in bad faith to give scientific front for sexual coercion. So I think that that's interesting. He says blue balls were a real medical thing. It wouldn't justify access or entitlement to another person's body. After all, relieving the condition does not require a partner. So that's the part I really do agree with. So I don't have the clinical experience, right? I'm not a clinician. So when I'm reading the research, I have to go based on what I know in my experience with anatomy, physiology, and then also methodology and research theory and understanding, like, you know, clinical research. Like I've obviously taken courses in that. I don't have the clinical experience. So it's like, I don't see patients. I'm not a urologist, right? So it is important also to factor that in. But I wrote about this last summer and I said that, like, does it really matter if it's real or not? Because people are feeling pain. So in that case, like, it could be real. I don't have a penis. So like, I don't know that feeling, obviously. But I've seen a lot of research that this throbbing syndrome, so like genital throbbing, so that can be like just from arousal and then like not being able to do anything about it and like not being able to alleviate yourself, I guess, can be painful or uncomfortable, but it can happen actually in either or all like genders and sexes, because the clitoris also has erectile tissue, so it can happen there as well. And I noticed though that the respondents from that, and this is still up on my newsletter, it's under, it just is called like something about blue balls, I think, and you can scroll down, you can find it, but I just thought it was really interesting that even though both types of participants said that they had it, only one type of participant, which was the female participant, said that they had frequently felt coerced as a result of it. So it doesn't really matter to me if blue balls is like real condition, if it gets a qualifier, if it gets a code, you know, like I don't really care. The problem is that how it's being used and weaponized against somebody, that can definitely be an issue. Because if you're in pain because you didn't come, you can just go jerk off. You know what I mean? Like if it's that big of an issue, you shouldn't be forcing someone to do anything they don't want to do, right? So does epididymal hypertension exist? I'm not a clinician. For me, I believe more in like genital throbbing syndrome. I think that's a good name for it. And if you can relieve it on your own, then you should, you know, but leave people out of it that don't want to be a part of it. All right. Last one here, breeding fetish. So people ask me a lot, is this a real thing? Is this like just an evolutionary thing? I'm not a huge like participant in the whole evolutionary psychology thing for two reasons. One, I'm not a psychologist, but two, I think it often uses what our ancestors did or what we're biologically innate for to, again, kind of that weaponized tool against people to say, this is what we're meant to do, right? But here's the thing that's really interesting about the breeding fetish. A lot of the times, it's just about a gamble. It really is. It's just about a gamble. It's like the thrill of, is it going to happen or is it not? I think that is the risk factor, I think, is more exciting to people. Because when we talk about breeding fetishes, we're talking about like, we're not supposed to do this, or ooh, like something could happen, like a big thing. And it's like a big emotional response, which obviously can induce increased blood flow. And like anytime we are involving fear, sometimes it gets mixed with arousal. It's just part of that whole thing. Because when we're talking about people who are actively like trying to make a baby, and it might be more of a loving connection, we are doing this together, we're taking this step, it's so romantic, I don't think they usually classify themselves as having a breeding fetish. But also the term fetish gets thrown around really loosely. It, technically speaking, like if I'm going to be a stickler, it technically means something that has to be present for you to be aroused or desire sex. Like it depends which definition you're using. But you know, I think a breeding kink is a better word for it. But I mean, some people think it's hot because we're not really supposed to do this. And some people think it's hot because it's like, this is what we're meant to do. And breeding fetish or breeding kinks are a really hot topic in both psychology and often in the sociology of sex too. Because on one hand, there are a lot of people who are saying like, it's the evolutionary aspect. That's like, of course I find that hot because it's built in me, you know? And then I'm like, well, how do you explain people who have like a breeding fetish for a dildo that's squirting liquid, or, you know, that kind of thing. And they don't always have the answer for that. But on the other hand, well, maybe what we find hot is that we're taking a chance. We are fulfilling that assigned gender role that can be really turn on for a lot of people. We're doing something together. We're taking this leap together, or I'm asserting my dominance. Like I'm spreading my seed. That's a big thing too. When we talk about ejaculate, that's a huge thing that comes up, spreading the seed, planting seeds. And it reminds me that a lot of the time when we talk about sex ed, when we talk about physiology, when we talk about the anatomy of reproductive organs, we always focus on like the sperm meeting the egg, and like the sperm swims so far, and we neglect the fact that the egg is a lot more picky about the sperm that it takes in than people give it credit for a lot of the time. And there are channels in our cervical mucus that help the sperm with the seminal fluid around it swim up to meet the egg in the uterus. And there's a lot going on in terms of like the cervix being more moist and open. I know people hate that word. I'm so sorry if you're wearing headphones especially. But it's just really funny because like the sperm they're not the star of the show. They're actually kind of like these lazy little cells, and they need a lot of help to get where they're going. And that's just not the way that we talk about them. And there's a feminist essay from the 60s by Emily Martin called The Sperm and the Egg. And I reference it in my project that I'm working on. And it's just really interesting to see that happen online when I talk about the epididymis, when I talk about ejaculation, when I talk about all this stuff. Yeah, because, you know, our sperm are so strong. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, it takes two to tango. But whatever floats their boat, I guess. But I think a lot of people put a lot of weight into what they're meant to do during sex because it helps them and it protects them, I think, from finding out who they really are. And I don't mean that in a mean way. I mean that in the way that they're maybe afraid to go beyond the boundary and beyond, I guess, the bedroom too. Maybe that's a part of it. So are breeding kinks real? Anything can be a kink. So yeah, they are real, but how do I feel about them? I have some mixed thoughts. And I think I would rather do an episode about gender performance kinks and really break it down there. So this was by no means an exhaustive episode about coming and semen and all that stuff. And I'm going to dig into a lot more of this stuff throughout the season. We're going to talk about why some people find things humiliating that others find so hot and why some people find humiliation hot and others don't. I thought it would be good to set the scene with an episode about ejaculation because it really is a big topic and there's a lot to cover and there's a lot of ground to cover. But a really great listener asked a question. Let me play the audio clip, but just for context, last week I made a guide to condoms because, of course, some people get itchy and irritated after using them, and as a sex educator, I really love promoting them. And also, just as someone who uses them, I cannot be on hormonal birth control due to a complication, so I rely on them if I don't want to get pregnant. So I definitely know a thing or two about these condom brands. I've tried a lot of them. So if you want to read that, it has all the tips and tricks about the size, the formula, the lubes, everything. It's on my Substack, which is my name. It's birna.substack.com. The newsletter is called On the Nightstand, which I find very cute. I hope you do too. It's like kind of like a little extension of Beyond the Bedroom. This is more like what's in the bedroom sometimes. So I thought that was cute. But anyway, here is the question she asked about condoms. Hey guys, so it's me, but from the future. So unfortunately, I had to remove the original voicemail. You may notice that an earlier version of this episode did include it, but the question essentially was, I like to use condoms, but find that they sometimes slip off. Is this something that you've heard of happening? And what can I do to prevent this? So as for condoms slipping off, I definitely have heard of this happening for a couple reasons. So the ring part of the condom, which is at the base, it might not be sticking to the base of the penis because of too much lube. Sometimes too much gets like inside and it creates this weird like frictiony roll down thing. Sometimes people have too much body hair. Sometimes they have too much hair on the shaft actually, and it can like cause it not to stick really well. But then sometimes it's just like the condom is too tight and it's rolling down. Otherwise, if it's not at the base, the problem often also is at the tip. So there might be too much space at the tip. So it creates this like pulling effect when you're thrusting because the friction, the tip is loose and then like the rest of the condom moves around as a result. And then eventually it's like they are thrusting within the condom and the condom's moving around and then eventually it'll just slip off. So sometimes it's because it's too tight and then, but most of the times it's because it's too loose. Avoid those like condoms that have like the thicker material. Try brands with smaller reservoir tips or applying a water-based lube and not silicone to the shaft. That can help. And the vaginal walls may be pulling it down. So also make sure that you definitely are aroused and that vaginal tenting is happening. You have enough vaginal lubrication also. You might want to just put a little bit more lube on the shaft. One of the things I'll also say is that sometimes it's the way that we are having sex with condoms. So sometimes people have to practice like jerking off in a condom. And for people who like can't be on birth control or like, you know, hormonal contraceptives, for people who are using them to prevent STI transmission, it's really important that you find condoms that fit well, that feel good. I really wish there was like a way to do a starter pack almost with like a bunch of different brands. And, you know, I would absolutely love that, but I don't think that that's possible. I mean, maybe it is, but there's probably some retail laws and issues and marketing stuff, you know, that prevents people from doing that. It would be so cool if that was a thing, to be able to try a bunch of different brands and sizes and thickness and formulas and lubes and find your favorite, like a goodie bag of 15 of them. But I mean, even then it might not even, I don't know. Sometimes you wear a condom once and it's like, oh, this is very different than another one that I've used. And so you get a little bit uncomfortable and it doesn't feel that great. But then the second time you wear it, you're like, oh, I am used to this. It can be a lot of different things. I'm sorry. I would need more like a visual, but I obviously do not want one. But you know what I mean? Like, I want to be able to be more hands-on sometimes and I have to like stop myself, but more in a helpful way. Like, I'm so jaded by all this. It's like my friends that do work in healthcare, they just see genitals all day. And so to the point where they just don't even register it as something different. Like, that's sometimes how I feel as well, especially for some of the research projects I've done where I had to look at like a lot of pornographic material. Sometimes I would be like eating my lunch, like watching something, because I'm, you know, looking at the different ways that people rub their clitoris in like a figure eight and rhythmic. And I'm like taking notes while I'm literally eating chips and like eating my sandwich. And I'm like, huh, my job is a little bit weird, huh? Well, I'll leave you with that note. But like I said, this is not like an exhaustive ejaculate episode. But I look forward to more of them in the future. And thank you so much for listening. If you made it this far, I really do love you. And check out my newsletter. It's, like I mentioned, on the nightstand. Subscribe to my Substack. You'll get some bonus content there. I have some Valentine's Day stuff coming out, which is going to be so cute and fun. On kind of like a more serious note, I do want to mention something. On the day that I'm recording this, a really amazing community leader passed away. And so I just want everyone to take a moment to think about Cecilia Gentile. I really can't even wrap my mind around this, but because she just turned 52 last week, but she was such a beautiful and fierce and brilliant leader, and just so much of what I know about advocacy and organizing and social change came directly from Cecilia. She was also really funny, and she was lovable, and she was loving, and she was compassionate, and she was just so, she demanded attention in such a unique and beautiful way. I met her for the first time in 2018, and I was lucky enough to work on a project that she was a part of. And it was during a time of my life that I didn't really know what to do with all of this angst that I had. I was so upset at how sex workers were being treated. I was so upset at how policy was making it harder for people to live their lives and to seek help and resources. And so many people were being punished for seeking help. She helped me turn that angst into real power. And it was a pivotal moment for me. I will never forget the day that I first met her. And I want you all to, if you enjoy my work as a sex educator, I hope you know that so much of what I do comes from my roots in organizing and advocating for social change for those in the transgender community, for sex workers, for those who were discriminated against based on their gender expression, their sexual identities. It's the reason that I went back to school, is because of the work that she and others were doing. She's a New York icon, She's an icon just in general. And so I'll leave you with that. Please look up Cecilia Gentili and her work and what she's done and how she's moved through this world. It's amazing. And she had a memoir that actually recently came out called Faltas. And she lobbied in Albany multiple times for different causes. She was part of the intersex cause, the transgender cause, the walking while trans ban, decriminalizing sex work. There's so much that she was a monumental effort in doing, and she kept the morale up. And she was such a morale booster. And I just, something that I think about when I talk about my work in sex education and advocating for sexual and reproductive rights is living in a life of service. And I definitely do feel that she inspired me to do that. And I hope I continue to do so. And now I really will leave you with that. And I hope you don't mind that I took a moment to share that with you all. Yeah, thank you so much for listening. And thank you for hearing me. Thank you for listening to me and my work and what I do and why I do it is because of this stuff. So thank you. And next week, we're diving into some Valentine's confessions. So if you want to leave me a voicemail for the podcast, you can do so either on my Instagram or an anonymous way, which is linked in my link tree, which will be in my Instagram or in the description down below. Or if you want to just send me a message with it, go ahead. I'm going to be reading them, reacting to them, so everyone can have a fun Valentine's Day, even if they're single, coupled up. It's going to be a spicy one. It's going to be a really, really, really spicy one. Like, viewer discretion advised spicy, all right? Do not let your headphones die and have this playing in a crowded subway, all right? Okay, well, I'll leave you with that. Thank you so much for listening. I love you all. And sending you so much love all the way here from DC.